Welcome once again to our series of programs on salvation history, the New Testament, the Acts of the Apostles, Epistles, and the Book of Revelation. This is Chuck Johnson, teacher at John Paul II Catholic High School in Terre Haute, Indiana. Our guest again is Ron Eldred, who teaches history and religion at John Paul II. Ron, let's go on in this session into debate about the scholars regarding the role of St. Paul, that St. Paul played in the formation of the early church. Pauline Hellenistic versus so-called Patrine Judaic Christianity. Why don't you go back and give us a kind of a synopsis of where we were at the last meeting?
At the end of the last session, we had been discussing an alleged struggle that certain scripture scholars and historians have made between St. Peter and St. Paul for control of the Catholic Church. That's really what it boiled down to, or for Christianity. And supposedly St. Paul, the certain scholars that we were talking about, he supposedly won out. At least his theology won out. The idea is that the Pauline brand of Christianity was Greek, for the most part, or Hellenistic. And St. Peter's brand of Christianity was more Jewish or Judaic, centered around the city of Jerusalem.
Now, Ron, hasn't there been a lot of discussion over the years on how Jewish St. Paul was, or how much Hellenized or Greek he was?
Yes, there has been a lot of debate about that. Some have argued that although he was a Jew, raised as a strict Pharisee, he was also well-schooled in Greek philosophy, which is reflected in his theology. And that's what we're basically going to discuss in this session. We just discussed earlier in this series that he was born and raised in Tarsus of Cilicia, which was a Roman province in what is today's southern Turkey. Tarsus was a large, maybe a city of a quarter of a million people, a rich city, situated on one of the most frequented roads in the world at the time. It was known as a center for education and philosophy. Strabo, the famous Greek geographer, affirms that Tarsus at this time outshone even Athens and Alexandria and anywhere else for its education. He comments on the excellent schools of rhetoric there. Rhetoric, of course, is the art of persuasion, using language to persuade. The city was inhabited by Stoic philosophers, and according to one scholar, it was not a rare thing to see one of these exposing his teaching on the roadside somewhere. He says that St. Paul received this culture in his education. In many of his letters, he mentions local terms, arguments drawn from the philosophical and dramatic culture of his time. At that time, Tarsus was one of the intellectual centers then of the Roman Empire. Although schooled in Greek philosophy and rhetoric, St. Paul came from a family of strict Pharisees, and from his earliest years, learned the Jewish law and traditions. We read a lot about this in Acts chapter 16 and in chapter 22. In fact, as a youth, he sat at the feet of the famous Gamaliel in Jerusalem. He was a very famous rabbi and doctor of the law. We have seen that because of his blind zeal for the Mosaic law, he began to persecute all Christians on whom he could lay his hands, considering it his duty to do so. You might recall the story of how he held the coats of those who were stoning to death St. Stephen, the first martyr of the church. It wasn't until his conversion to Christianity on the road to Damascus and his experience trying to convert Gentiles to the faith that he became less zealous for the entire Mosaic law. especially for those matters dealing with ritual purity, dietary practices, sabbatical observances, and circumcision for men. Although I must say, he did continue to practice these personally in his own life, but he was not requiring these things, of course, of his Gentile converts.
So he was seeing it as obligatory upon himself as a Jew.
Yes, as a Jew.
Okay. It reminds me of the book Jew and Greek, which distinguishes the two. Tell us about those scholars who take the position that St. Paul was greatly influenced by Greek philosophy.
F.F. Powell argues that Paul, in his epistles, used many of Plato's ideas in his writings, even to the point of using the same metaphors and language. She states that he was the first great Christian missionary and writer of a significant part of the New Testament, who fused the philosophy of Plato with the story of Jesus. She claims that for centuries, theologians seem to have preferred Paul's doctrines to the teachings of Jesus and have shaped the message over the years that our faith must be placed in Jesus' death, not in his life. She goes on to say, as Christianity took shape, Paul battled to get his Greco-Roman dogma accepted. Those persons supporting Paul soon developed a strategy to accomplish that feat. Belittling the disciples was one approach to the problem, it appears, she says. This is especially true of Peter and some of Paul's Galatian passages. That's her position, of course.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out where that's found in Scripture.
Yes, that's...
I find no echoes of that, okay.
I don't either. Also another scholar, Daniel Boyarin, who is a Talmud scholar, has argued that Paul's theology of the Spirit is more deeply rooted in Hellenistic Judaism than generally believed. In his book, Radical Jew, he calls a Radical Jew, Boyarin argues that Paul of Tarsus combined the life of Jesus with Greek philosophy to reinterpret the Hebrew Bible in terms of the Platonic opposition between the ideal, which is real, and the material, which is false. Paul saw in the symbol of a resurrected Jesus the possibility of a spiritual rather than a corporal Messiah. He used this notion of Messiah to argue for a religion through which all people, not just descendants of Abraham, that is Jews, could worship the God of Abraham. Unlike Judaism, which holds that it is proper religion, is the proper religion only of the Jews, Pauline Christianity claimed to be the proper religion for all people. He goes on to say that, in other words, by appealing to the Platonic distinction between the material and the ideal, Paul showed how the Spirit of Christ could provide all people a way to worship God, the God who had previously been worshipped only by the Jews and Jewish proselytes, although Jews claimed that he was the one God, the one and only God of all. There are examples that he quotes in Romans 8, 2 Corinthians, Galatians, and this whole thing about Plato's philosophy. You know, my class on apologetics with my students, we go in lots of detail explaining those kind of things, so they'll know what that means. And so obviously we don't have time to do that in a series like this.
But one of the things that does pop up, when he talking about abstraction, show me where Paul, when he talks about how a Christian should live and how he defines love, how it's forbearing and things like this. How is this abstract? This is not an intellectual exercise. This touches the very marrow of human existence. So it's hard to understand the critique that's being made here as if Paul is talking about abstractions.
Yeah, these people are arguing that Paul was really Greek.
Yeah, and I'm wondering where is that showing up in the New Testament?
And we'll get to
in
that.
His writings, yes. Paul's. So anyway, so that leads me to believe this is just one interpretation made by someone about Paul, but it's where's the evidence?
Well, Boyarin, he even goes further. He argues that Paul made his version of Christianity appealing to Gentiles. He also sees that by making it Greek, he also sees that Platonic reworking of both Jesus' teachings and Pharisaic Judaism is essential to the emergence of Christianity as a distinct religion because it justified a Judaism without Jewish law. Well, I don't think we Catholics can object to some of this, but the 19th edition of the Catholic Encyclopedia Pedia essentially agrees with his argument to some extent that only a person like St. Paul, who was intimately familiar with both Jewish and Greek culture, could successfully preach the gospel to the Greek and Roman world at the time. Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt that St. Paul was a very strict Pharisaic Jew who was trained as a Pharisee, yet at the same time he was schooled in the philosophy of the Greeks, and that he knew how they thought, and it probably, the two together, the both of them put together, did make it possible for him to go out and to appeal. He knew what the kind of arguments you would have to use to appeal to a Greek and Roman, Latin kind of population, to convert them to Christianity.
So he was a more cosmopolitan man.
Yes.
Than if he had just spent most of his life in Judea.
But he wasn't nearly as Greek as these people
right.
that we've been quoting here.
Right. Now, some scholars have maintained that it wasn't the apostles, such as St. Paul and St. John, that Hellenized Christianity, but the second century apologists, such as Justin Martyr and his student Tatian.
That's true. This is especially true of the 19th century German theologian and historian Adolf von Harnack, who makes this kind of claim. He was instrumental in promoting the idea of a Hellenization of early Christianity. According to one scholar, his basic thesis describes a history of decline and corruption, a movement away from the pure biblical passage or the pure biblical message of Jesus of Nazareth, still uncontaminated by any external influence, to later theological speculations which are heavily based on Greek philosophy. According to Harnack, the break took place somewhere in the second century, not later than Irenaeus of Lyon. The Catholic Encyclopedia dismisses this thesis by saying, that is Harnack's thesis, by saying, quote, "This contention can best be refuted by showing that the essential doctrines of Christianity are contained already in the New Testament scriptures, while giving at the same time their due force to the traditions of corporate Christianity. If the Nicene Creed cannot be proved article by article from the sacred records, interpreted by the tradition that preceded them and determined their canon, then the rationalist assertion will have some support." That ends that quote. By rationalist, the author of the article says he's referring to the liberal Protestant theologians and scripture scholars that we discussed in our series Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages, which of course includes von Harnack. By the essential doctrines of Christianity already contained in the New Testament, in the New Testament scriptures, the author means the entire New Testament record. In regard to this, it states, quote, "Christ," we're in the encyclopedia now, "Christ taught by his life no less than by his words, and it was his actions and sufferings as well as his oral lessons that his apostles preached. Here it suffices to note that Christian theology became, in the hands of the apologist, the synthesis of all speculative truth. It met and conquered the various imperfect systems that possessed men's minds at its birth and arose after that event." End of quote. To put it another way, the Christian apologists of the second century didn't begin to apply Greek philosophy to defend Christian doctrines until they came under attack by pagan philosophers in the second century. Mm-hmm. This would include, of course, people such as Justin Martyr and Tatian and Irenaeus of Lyon and Saint Ignatius of Antioch and people of that sort. In the final analysis, I don't think that we can attribute the application of Greek philosophy to the Christian doctrines in any major way to St. Paul or to St. John, for that matter, but mostly to the second century apostolic fathers, those mm-hmm. who took the place of the apostles right. in the second generation and the third generation, people like Justin Martyr and others. They're the ones who really began to apply some Greek philosophy to understanding the Catholic faith and in formulating doctrines, including in creeds such as the Nicene Creed.
Well, don't you think then that in fact St. Paul could be hostile to the use of Greek philosophy being applied to Christianity?
Yes, he could. He may have been, schooled in Greek philosophy and rhetoric and things of that sort, yet at the same time he was also a Pharisee, a very, very strict Pharisee.
By his own statement.
By his own statement. And he lived a life
that's right.
Like that. He practiced it even after he became a Christian. Regarding this matter, the encyclopedia, the Catholic Encyclopedia, now this is the 1911 edition, says, quote, "But while recognizing this providential dispensation in the election of St. Paul, we cannot, in fact, of his own express and emphatic testimony, go on to assert that he universalized Christianity as Philo attempted to universalize Judaism by adding to its ethical content the merely natural religion of the Greek thinkers of his own more sublime and pure conceptions." Philo was a first right. century Jewish philosopher who lived in Alexandria. Very, very influential. It offers proof of this, the encyclopedia does, by referring to St. Paul's first epistle to the Corinthians, where he rebukes their factious spirit, whereby some of them had styled themselves partisans of Apollos, a learned Alexandrian, and repudiates again and again that very attempt to make Christianity plausible by tricking it out in the garb of current speculations. Paul goes on to cite in 1 Corinthians, which states, quote, "For Jews demand signs, and Greeks seek wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to Jews and folly to Gentiles. But to those who are called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men." This is 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 22 and 26. It's a very famous quote, in fact. The encyclopedia concludes by asserting that St. Paul was not indebted for his Christology, that is, his theology of Christ, who Christ is, to Philo, this Jewish philosopher, or his school, or any similarity of terminology which may occur in the works of the two authors. They might reasonably be ascribed to the metaphors already embodied in the language that both of these men use, both Paul and, of course, Philo. It's true that Greek philosophy was used to a considerable extent to defend the faith against the assaults of heresies such as the Arian and the Manichaean heresies in the 3rd and 4th centuries. And as we've discussed in various series for Catholic Radio, the Catholic Church did employ Greek philosophy to deepen the understanding of the teachings of Jesus. It is well known that St. Augustine Christianized Plato's philosophy, and St. Thomas Christianized Aristotle's philosophy, especially his metaphysics. But in St. Paul, you just really don't find a lot of Greek philosophy.
Wasn't it true that St. John could also be hostile to Greek-Roman culture?
Yes, and I think this was given rise by the fact that John begins his gospel, "In the beginning was the Word." And of course, the Greek word for the Word is logos. And logos was a term that floated around a lot in that time
right.
among Greek philosophers. So some have claimed that St. John used that
right.
to appeal to a Hellenistic or a Greek
right.
Audience. One of the most prominent who's made this kind of argument is a Franciscan priest by the name of Hans Joseph Clouk, who is a professor of New Testament studies at the University of Chicago's Divinity School and an expert on St. Paul and St. John, as well as on the Greco-Roman world. He maintains that St. John's revelation, his book of Revelation, the New Testament Apocalypse, takes a very negative stance against Greco-Roman culture, civilization, politics, and religion. In other words, he's saying that even St. John is not overly influenced by Greek right. philosophy, that it's probably more Jewish than in orientation. The Roman Empire is inspired by the great dragon, who is thrown down to the earth from heaven and takes the shape of a horrible beast with seven heads, rising out of the Mediterranean Sea. This is in Revelations 12 and 13, both chapters. A voice from heaven advised the Christian, "Come out of her, my people, so that you do not take part in her sins." This is found in Revelation 18. He states that this quote, Professor Clark states that this quote refers to the great city of Babylon, a code name for the Roman Empire at that time. Even if we do not understand this literally, that is, as a command for Christians to leave their cities and homes, it implies at least the necessity of taking a spiritual distance from the surrounding culture,
right,
the surrounding Greek and Roman culture.
Right.
Now, this is John telling them
yeah.
to do that. So, you know, he must have not have been overly influenced by Greek philosophy, if
yeah,
at all.
Since he's debunking it
yes,
right there.
Yes.
Yes. Now, isn't it true that some of the early church fathers were hostile toward the application of Greek philosophy to Christianity?
Oh, yes, that's very true. Even though they were deeply indebted to Greek philosophy, St. Jerome, for example, and Tertullian were both highly critical of pagan civilization, of which, of course, Greek philosophy
right.
Was a part. Jerome wrote one of his early letters asking, quote, "What does Horace have to do with the Psalms? What does Virgil," of course he was a Latin poet, "have to do with the Gospels? And what does Cicero," who of course was a great philosopher and orator, "have to do with the Apostle Paul?" His answer to each of these questions was nothing. Decades later, he asked, and of course this is
his famous
one. Yes, this is Jerome again, what do Aristotle and Paul have in common? What do Plato and Peter have in common? His answers were essentially the same, you know, nothing. In the same vein, Tertullian is known for his famous aphorism.
Yep.
What does Athens have to do with Jerusalem? What does the Academy have to do with the church? One scholar has said that this shows that for him, Athens stands for Greek philosophy and human wisdom, and Jerusalem represents Christian faith uncorrupted by the sophistication of speculation and learning. In spite of this, the church came to rely heavily on Greek philosophy to formulate and defend its doctrines. And in the words of one scholar, it was mainly through Christianity that the heritage of Greco-Roman antiquity was handed down through the ages of modern times. We can't understand the 4th century Nicene Creed without a knowledge of Greek philosophy that was used to formulate the doctrines.
So you can see that Christianity did react to its context, but it was, what would you say, the Syriac heart expressing itself in an idiom not native to itself.
Yes.
But if it were to be all things to all men, of necessity, it had to enter into conversation with the culture. The idea of Christian faith uncorrupted by the sophistication of speculation and learning was the main idea behind the Protestant Reformation, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. In fact, it was the driving force of Luther and Calvin's Sola Scriptura, or the idea that all of Revelation is to be found in the Bible that we discussed earlier in this series. And I might add, of course, to Protestant liberal movement of the 19th century and the Catholic modernist movement of the late 19th century and the early 20th century, and I might add probably carries on right down to the present day in the remnants of modernism. Rather than creating a new religion, the Protestants of the Reformation thought they were getting back to Christianity before it was corrupted by Greek influences
right.
in the second and the third, fourth centuries. According to Scott Hahn in his Covenant and Communion, the biblical theology of Pope Benedict XVI, quote, "This process began in the Middle Ages and reached its full flower in the Reformation with Martin Luther's efforts to remove the influences of Catholic philosophy and dogma and returned to what he believed to be the original purity of Scripture alone. In different forms, the sola scriptura principle became a key premise of the liberal theology of the 19th and 20th centuries. In seeking the unadulterated message and person of Jesus, liberal theology treated the biblical word as a historical record to be read without reference to philosophical and theological formulations made using Greek language and Greek philosophical tools. This meant returning to a kind of literalism, uninformed by such products of philosophical reasoning as the doctrines concerning the Trinity and the divinity of Christ. Ending that quote. We spent many half-hour sessions in our series interpreting the Bible through the ages, pursuing different aspects of the subject. The Reformers and the liberal theologians of all times have hated the scholastic methodology and natural theology that the Church inherited from the Greeks. Hahn states that, quote, this new theological outlook was greatly influenced by the rise of the natural sciences and the achievements of technology, as well as by Kant's philosophical self-limitation of reason to only those things that can be perceived by the senses. These influences, in turn, gave rise to the modern understanding that truth and certainty are a function of what can be observed and either verified or falsified through experimentation in the laboratory. Human reason, in the modern period, has since come to be seen as limited strictly to understandings, to seeking understandings that conform to these scientific canons of truth and certainty. Because they cannot be answered according to these modern canons, questions about such things as the existence of God or the meaning of human existence are discarded as unscientific or pre-scientific. Since religious faith in the modern age is no longer viewed as a source of true knowledge about humans and the world, rather it is regarded as a feeling or sentiment and a matter of individual or subjective preference, end of quote. The idea of religion being a matter of feeling and sentiment is what we discussed in this and other series as a religion of the heart, a type of religious sentiment inherent in Protestantism and liberal theology of all stripes, including that of Catholic modernist. Both of these movements have done everything they could to de-Hellenize Christianity, that is, to remove the part of religion that utilizes reason in the Greek sense to more deeply understanding the truths of the Catholic faith, which of course are the teachings of Jesus. It was these two movements that separated faith from reason, which Pope John Paul II tried so hard to restore, especially in his very famous book, Fides et Ratio. And Pope Benedict XVI was valiantly continuing this effort before his retirement.
Well, Ron, we're running out of time. We'll take this up again in our next session. Thank you so much.